Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from me.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and tonight we'll be talking about the overall concept of, I guess, what I would clinically call bereavement. With me tonight, I have Heidi Nielsen Packard, who currently lives in Georgia, but is originally from Mesa, Arizona. Her husband is an Army doctor stationed at Fort Benning. She has four children, ages 15 to 9, and she is currently in school finishing up her bachelor's in history and looking forward to applying to graduate school next year, hopefully getting your PhD. Is that right, Heidi?
Yep, it is.
All right, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
You come from a large, faithful Mormon family. You made sure that when you told me that there are 11 children, that they're all from one marriage and there's no adoptions or twins.
So yes.
11 pregnancies your mother went
yes.
through successfully, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And I guess the reason why you're on the show is because your family in particular has had two tragedies, different in scope and I guess in finality, but you had a sister who was diagnosed with cancer, correct? And we're going to talk a little bit about her. Mm-hmm. And you also had a brother and sister-in-law who were involved in a very severe plane accident. And both of them survived, but there were some serious health repercussions from that, I think, especially for your sister-in-law. So you can talk a little bit about that. So really what we're here to talk about tonight, just for me to kind of set up the agenda a little bit, is tell us a little bit about your story and, you know, what these situations were that your entire family kind of had to go through. And looking at it from the Mormon perspective, I'm going to be curious as to how the grieving process was maybe, I guess, approached by your family, and especially with looking at it through the faith lens. And both, I'm hoping that we can kind of tease out both positives and negatives that came from that in your opinion. You're only speaking for yourself, I know. So lots of other people, I'm sure, that would have an opinion on this in your family. So why don't we just get started with you kind of giving us a little bit more detail about, do you want to start maybe with your sister and we'll go from there?
Okay, sure. So just to make it short and sweet, and I'll do the facts and then we can go back, I guess, and fill in more details as we need it maybe. My sister is 2 years older than me. When we roomed together at BYU, grew up together. When she was 25, she had just been married a few months, and she was diagnosed with, they found a tumor wrapped around her spinal cord, a synovial sarcoma, and she had surgery on it immediately. They were not able to remove all of it because of, you know, the location. Chemo was not really an option either because of the type of tumor that it was. It wasn't, the chances of it working were not, you know, very good. So she did radiation therapy and the tumor was shrinking. And then this was back in 1999, the beginning of 2000, she became pregnant and she had a very difficult pregnancy, not in terms of, not because of the pregnancy, but because of the pain. She couldn't take any pain meds or, you know, reduced pain meds. So she had a lot of pain. She had her baby in September of 2001, and she passed away in December, on December 11th, 2001.
Goodness.
So her, you know, her baby was just a few months old. And So that's you know, the basics, I guess.
Okay.
of what happened.
Sure. Well, so why don't we go back? What birth order was she in the family?
So we were both. She's six and I'm seven, so we are just right there in the middle. Mm-hmm. Very large family. Very, like you said, very faithful. I guess your typical large Mormon family, I guess. I don't know. That's mm-hmm. that's just from my experience, you know, that we were typical from, you know, in the community that we grew up in.
And I'm assuming close as far as emotionally close to one another and supportive of one another.
Yes. I think I remember growing up, you know, because I think birth order had a lot to do with it. You know, being in the middle of my family, I had so many siblings that had already, you know, gone ahead and were successful and, you know, did everything right, got married in the temple, went on their missions, you know. And so from my perspective, this was never explicitly said, but I remember always kind of looking around me and seeing, you know, maybe other people in our ward or other friends, you know, that maybe had problems in their family. And I remember thinking, wow, our family's just, you know, nothing bad has ever happened to us. We must be really righteous, you know, mm-hmm. and really blessed, because we just, you know, there's so many of us and we, we're so blessed, so lucky, so good. I mean, you know, just a very, I don't know. I guess I had a very idyllic childhood in that sense. You know, I never had any traumatic events. I never knew anybody that died. You know, we just didn't really have any problems. But so we had a good family vibe, I guess, or feeling going on. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that we were emotionally it's hard to say. I don't know how to describe it, but certainly on very good terms with each other, but also maybe there were things that were difficult for my family to talk about with each other. Maybe more personal feelings, you know.
Okay.
We can get into it more, I guess, as the story unfolds. But yeah, just close, but not, maybe not so much emotionally close.
Okay. So maybe I'm getting the sense that close in the sense of sharing all these kind of lifestyle, day-to-day activities and, you know, kind of being together. But maybe if you were questioning or trying to figure different things out, that all of a sudden it wasn't as safe to talk about things that were maybe a little bit out of the norm or something along those lines?
Exactly. Yes. Okay. It wasn't, there was a program, okay. A system, you know, and you followed the system, and it was a good system. It worked really well. And, you know, and I had lots of siblings that were examples of that. So,
and by a system, are you specifically referring to kind of the Mormon system? Like, we've got family home evening on Mondays, we've got church on Sundays, we've got, you know, scripture studies together, like all is kind of a lot of absolutely. Routine and structure. Is that kind of what
yes,
you're referring to?
Yes, yes, very much that, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, so give me a little bit of a sense of what it was like, you know, when kind of the news broke that your sister had this disease and that she was really facing something very serious. Was that pretty clear right from the get-go, or was there some questioning about that or denial or?
Yes. So I remember the moment when Charity, my sister, came over with her husband and they had just met with her physician, and they'd gotten the results back from, you know, that her tumor was basically he had told her it was terminal, in not so many words. The news was not good. And I remember I was there for some, I don't know why I was there, but for some reason I was at my mom's house. And she was sitting on the couch telling my mom this and, you know, crying. And my family is very, very stoic and a pretty happy family. Not a lot of crying that went on in our family. And when someone did cry, it was a little bit like, oh, what do? You know? And I remember feeling that way, not knowing what to think or what to do or how to act, just feeling very awkward, but also shocked. And my mom's response was, of course, to be, you know, shocked and all of those feelings. But then she kind of, you know, took this added, like, okay, I could just kind of see this energy come up inside her. And she just said, this, we're going to fight this. You're going to beat this. You're going to do it. And, you know, I know you can do it. And I don't know, I didn't have that same optimism that my mom did, but that's kind of the optimism that my parents had through up until maybe the last couple of months of her life. They had this incredible faith and optimism. My father gave her a priesthood blessing early on. I actually wasn't there because by then my husband and I had moved to Maryland, but I remember my parents telling me about it. And he had given her a priesthood blessing and commanded her or promised her that she would, you know, she would be healed. And I think that for some of my siblings, that was just enough. They fully believed that she would be healed. For me, in the meantime, I was living, you know, I'm living on the East Coast and, you know, away from everybody else. I don't have any firsthand information. I'm getting everything filtered through my mom. But from what I was hearing, you know, my husband's in medical school and he's kind of saying, this doesn't look very good. But yet my family had this, you know, total strong faith that she was going to be healed. So there was a total disconnect between what I was hearing from, you know, maybe the scientific side of things and what my family believed.
Okay, so there was definitely a very spiritual, almost desperation of your parents that, hey, we can rely on these spiritual tools, you know, priesthood blessings, optimism, you know, rely on God, and in a sense, they put their daughter in God's hands and had a lot of faith in that, is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. And that doesn't mean that they also didn't seek good medical care. They did, and she, you know, tried to find the best doctors as well. But yes, I think in their minds, it was very much do all that you can do. You know, find the best doctors, do everything that you can do, and then God is going to make up the rest, and he's going to heal her and bless her.
So, in a sense, having this priesthood blessing where these promises have been made, do you feel like that gave everybody room to relax or to just assume things would work out or maybe not
Yes.
face the more difficult possibilities?
Yes, absolutely. And I remember a conversation that I had. At some point, this was shortly, I think, after she'd had her baby. So it was sometime in the fall. And remember, she died in December. I called one of my sisters because I in my family, it's so big, we wouldn't often talk to each other. We would just call my mom, and my mom would kind of give us the update on everybody, you know. Sure. And this was before Facebook, you know, and right. So I, you know, I was mostly just talking to my mom and hearing what was going on through my mom. And I just, I kind of felt like my mom maybe was being, my parents were being overly optimistic. And so I called one of my sisters who lives near my parents, sees them all the time, you know, to see what she thought. And, you know, I said, do you feel at all like, you know, mom and dad are being overly optimistic? And she just said, no. She said, I've never even thought about it. I don't know for sure, but I think my question actually kind of made her stop and think, because she, in her mind, there really was no, she was, in her mind, Charity, my sister, was going to be healed. You know, there was no, because my dad had given her a blessing, and she just kind of assumed that she was going to be healed. And so, I don't know, it was an interesting experience for me. And I think overall, it really was created a sense of distance between me and my family, because obviously I was physically far away, but it made me feel like I don't think the same way as them. I'm different than them, because they're all so optimistic, and they're all so sure that this is, you know, she's going to be healed. And I didn't have that same, you know,
that same sense.
Whether it was faith, whether it was just optimism, whether it was, you know, denial, I don't know, but right. I didn't have that. And so it created this distance that I couldn't express, because I didn't want to seem like I was, you know, being negative or not having enough faith, or, you know, because then I'm not fitting into the system.
So very difficult to talk about those doubts or fears that you were having, because in a sense, you were Debbie Downer or something along those lines. Like, you felt like, I'm going to just make the situation worse if I talk about these things.
Right, exactly.
Just to put things into context a little bit, where were you at maybe with your own relationship with Mormonism at the time that this was all happening?
I was very, I mean, I'm, you know, I was always a believer. I never had a rebellious period in my life. You know, I always stuck with the program, followed the rules, did what I was supposed to do. And I, at this point, I don't think that I guess I'd always been the kind of Mormon that was a little bit more skeptical of maybe like priesthood blessings. You know, I had faith in the priesthood and believed that, you know, God could, you know, his will could be done through all these kinds of things. But I wasn't one to ever go seek out a priesthood blessing. At this point in time, the months leading up to her death, I don't think that my faith was necessarily challenged or changed during that time. It wasn't until after she died that I really felt a lot of things and thought about a lot of things and kind of, you know, had some new beliefs and opinions that evolved after that. Okay. But at this point, yeah, it was very much just I don't know, maybe because my husband was in medical school and we were surrounded by, and he was always, you know, surrounded by medicine and science and all of that. It just wasn't something that I wasn't questioning God or doubting God. It was just more, my family, I guess. Like, why is my family, why do they think this way? And I don't. I'm not fitting into my family and the way that my family thinks about things. It wasn't really, I'm not fitting into Mormonism or the church.
Right. Okay. So just to get a little bit more clarity on your sister's story, what was this decision to have a baby about? Was that something that was very much thought through and, you know, here, I want to have this experience before I die? Did she think she was going to die? Was it an accident? Like, can you explain a little bit more about, because I'm assuming at the time she got pregnant, she was still under treatment.
Yes, the tumor had shrunk to the extent obviously it was very small, but it wasn't truly in remission because, you know, knowing what I know now about cancer and just because I've had friends that have also been through similar things, you know, I know so much more now than I did back then. Looking back now, I realize of course, you know, it was just a matter of time before it came back. But yet at the time, our family was just not educated about cancer. We didn't know how it worked really. I think there was this sense that, yeah, you know, the radiation therapy had worked. The tumor had shrunk. And with God's, you know, extra help there, it was going to be gone. And so, so that's kind of the point she was at when she became pregnant. And honestly, I don't really know how deliberate it was. I remember when she told me she was pregnant, the impression that I got was that it was an accident, but a very pleasant accident. Very much something that she had wanted.
Sure.
And maybe thought that she couldn't get pregnant, you know, just because of everything that she'd been going through. That's the impression I got, but then I've talked to, you know, other members of my family, my mom, and they said, no, it was very deliberate. So, you know, I'm not sure, but yes, she very much wanted to be a mother. She very much wanted to have that experience. And she knew, you know, as her pregnancy progressed, she had to have known that she would not be, and she did. She did know that she was not going to be around to raise her child. But it wasn't something that we openly talked about a lot. I know she talked about it with her husband. I think she had some conversations with my parents, you know, towards the end. But it wasn't something that we talked about openly as a family. And it wasn't something that she just talked about with, you know, openly.
Okay. So let me ask you that. I mean, this is a really close sister of yours. You're very close in age. You've shared a lot of experiences, obviously, growing up. And like you mentioned, you roomed together in college and probably went through a lot of similar experiences together, just developmentally. So what was this like for you? And did you ever get a chance to talk to her about your feelings or have a conversation about what this really meant for your relationship with her?
No, I didn't. And that is one of the, you know, it is the biggest regret of my life. I don't have very many regrets, but that is the one big one in my life, is that I didn't have that conversation with her, or conversations with her. And I think the reason for that, well, a couple of interesting things leading up to that. So I was pregnant as well, at the same time that she was, but I was living in Maryland. And, you know, so she and I would kind of keep in touch and you know, talk about our pregnancies and how big we were, you know, just different stuff over the phone. But we didn't talk about her cancer. That was not, we just didn't talk about it. And
she, like it was a taboo subject, or like she didn't want to talk about it, or just you didn't know how to bring it up, or?
Yeah, it was just kind of, I don't know that it was taboo, but yeah, it was just, I didn't want to bring it up, and she didn't want to talk, she wasn't bringing it up, and so we just didn't talk about it. And I guess I didn't want to bring it up because I didn't know how to talk about it. I didn't know what to say, and I didn't, this was just such a new thing, and nobody in my family knew how to talk about it. And then besides all that, I was getting this, you know, I kind of felt like maybe they were being falsely optimistic about things, and I saw it differently. So it made that even more, more of an awkward subject to talk about, because I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't want my negativity or my, perceived negativity to rub off on them. And so, she had her baby in September, and after that she was just basically on heavy painkillers because she was in so much pain. And she, at the time, my parents were still, they said, okay, they couldn't do any aggressive treatments while she was pregnant, but once she had the baby, then they could start doing some aggressive treatments. And, you know, so I was still hearing these from my mom. Well, we're going to go to Texas, and we're going to, you know, go to this hospital that, you know, has these good treatments, and we can do all these things. And, in the meantime, my husband looked at one of her latest MRI, results. My mom had emailed them to him or something. And he just, I remember him telling me, like, this is not curable. Like, she is very close to dying. And I was like, what? No, she's not. Like, no, that's not right. That's not what my mom is telling me. I don't know that this is true. And then finally, my mother-in-law, my husband's family, they also live in Arizona. My mother-in-law called me because she had been over to visit my sister and my mom. And she called me and she said, Heidi, you need to come home. Like, you need to come home now. You know, and I was due in December. And this was sometime a little bit before Thanksgiving.
This was your sister's mother-in-law who was telling you this?
No, this was my mother-in-law.
Oh, I see. I see.
My mother-in-law. Yes. Mm-hmm. And she had been to visit Charity and seen her. And she's the one that told me, you can't, because I had kind of thought I'd have my baby and then I'd maybe come for Christmas and see her. And she said, I don't think she's going to last till Christmas. You need to come now. And so I called my mom and I said, should I come? And my mom did say, yes, you should come. And so I flew there. You know, I only had 3 weeks until at my due date. I had to get special permission to fly there, you know, and it was kind of a big deal, but I got there fine, and we had a couple of weeks together. And, you know, I tried to go over there to my mom's house as much as I could and spend time with her. By that point, she really couldn't do a lot. She was laying down in bed all day. But again, it was, you know, obviously we talked about her cancer by that point because, I mean, she was obviously sick and, you know, she had pain and she, you know, she couldn't do everything that she normally could do. So obviously we couldn't ignore it. But we also didn't talk about the fact that she was going to die. And I think wrapped up in that, in one of the reasons why we also didn't do that, why we didn't talk about it, is the fact that there's this, you know, this belief that if she dies, it's just for a short time. We're going to be reunited again. We're going to be together forever. So there's this kind of this implication that if you're too sad or if you're too distraught over death, then you don't have the right perspective. You're not looking at the full plan of salvation, or you don't maybe have the faith that you should have, or you don't understand the plan of salvation. You know, it's like it just was something that I didn't feel like I could openly talk about or process with her or my family, for whatever reason. And they weren't doing it with each other, at least that I saw. And right. So those conversations, that conversation never happened with her. And I wish that I could have, you know, had that.
What do you wish specifically you could have talked to her about or been more direct about?
I think just acknowledging, talking to her about how she feels about dying. What she thinks is going to happen. Is she scared? Is she at peace with it? Is she, what does she want specifically for her husband and for her child? I know that she did have those detailed conversations with her husband and with my parents. But I never had that conversation with her. So from my experience, that's something that I really regret not doing. And I guess I'm saying that my faith or my supposed lack of faith is one of the reasons why I didn't have that conversation. Because I didn't want to be the one to bring it up. You know, it was okay for her to talk about it with her husband because they had to be practical. You know, they had to acknowledge that they had to talk about the practicalities of what's going to happen when she dies. And, you know, what's going to happen to their child? Does she want him to get remarried? You know, there's just things you have to talk about. So I guess it was understandable that they would talk about it. But I didn't feel like it was something that, even at that point, if I were to bring it up, it would have seemed like I didn't have faith or I was being negative.
Okay. Well, it's interesting, I guess, how you frame things. And I want to make sure we, you know, kind of clarify a few things, because I feel like our American culture here in the United States is one that tends to be compared to other cultures in the world. We seem to be uncomfortable with death. We don't tend to pay a lot of attention to it when it happens. You know, it's kind of like we allow a 3-day type of, I don't know, moment to grieve. And then we are, I think you even mentioned your family being stoic. You know, you see people, you know, kind of quietly and calmly gathering around, you know, a graveyard or gravesite, whereas, you know, you see other cultures and there's, you know, weeping and wailing and processions, and you wear, you know, black for months. And, you know, it just seems like there's more of acknowledgement of what's happened. So some of this is, you know, American culture, and some of this of what we're talking about is Mormon culture. How do you differentiate between the two? Like, what things do you particularly feel maybe you're very Mormon about your experience? You mentioned permission not to grieve because you have to celebrate the fact that you're going to be an eternal family, right? So that's a very Mormon thing. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about even righteousness equaling blessings, right? You mentioned that at the very beginning. So let's have a little conversation just to kind of tease those things out as best as you feel you can.
So the question is, which of those things are specific to Mormonism? That's a difficult thing to do because everything is so, you know,
intertwined. Sure.
But I think, and also when you say the word, you know, Mormonism, there's a lot of things and a lot of families and a lot of experiences that come underneath that term. So, you know, my Mormon experience is going to be different from your Mormon experience. So that even makes it more difficult because I know right. that not every Mormon family is, you know, this way. But I think there are probably a lot of families that can identify with this, particularly, like you mentioned, the Stoic part of that. You know, I do think that kind of, at least the way that it's been told to me, is part of that, you know, comes from this pioneer heritage. You know, I had the ancestors that joined the church and crossed the plains and settled in Utah and Arizona and New Mexico. And, you know, they were polygamists and they farmed the land and all of those things. And so...
And I'm guessing they came from Norwegian or English countries.
Yes, they came from Denmark, mm-hmm. yes, in England, yes. So, you know, and that they brought that with them. And that's part of who I am. And so, yes, I think that optimism, like you talked about, I mean, that's American. There's American optimism. The Mormon, you know, belief system is also intertwined with that. And then it's also just my family in particular. I think my dad is a very optimistic person. That's just his personality. So I think it's a combination of so many different things that I'm not sure that I could even, you know, that I would be able to say this specifically is because of our Mormon belief. Now, but I will say that when it comes to, I guess, the church and going through this whole process, one thing that definitely does stand out to me that is truly uniquely Mormon is the sense of the support and the sense of community that our family felt, which was incredible. You know, just people stopping by all the time to visit my sister, cheer her up, bring her things. I mean, she had people calling her that she hadn't, you know, talked to for 10 years, you know, or, you know, old high school friends that stopped by. People, I mean, just people were so, so supportive and just did the nicest things. It helped out my mom in so many ways. And just, I mean, I can't even say enough good about how much support my family had from the community, from the Mormon community. And so I think that's also tied in with it too, because that sense of optimism was also in the community as well. It wasn't just my family. It was, you know, the people in our ward and the people, when I say community, I mean the Mormon community, you know, that would stop by. They brought with them this faith and this optimism. And I have mixed feelings about that because on the one hand, I think that's great. You know, optimism, positive energy, faith, these are good things that help people get through difficult times. So on the one hand, I think it's great. But on the other hand, it's difficult because you feel like, or at least I felt like, there wasn't room. And I'm actually a pretty positive person too. I wouldn't say I'm a depressive person, but I didn't feel like there was a place for me to grieve or be sad, even after my sister died.
Hmm.
Not just through her illness, but even after she died.
Right.
And it was hard. It was her illness. I mean, it was hard to see her sick because she was in a lot of pain. I mean, she was skin and bone. She weighed less than 100 pounds. Her face was horribly swollen because of the pressure around her neck. they never really got her pain under control. And so it was just, it was hard. It was really hard to see her in so much pain.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a place to deal with that sadness or those difficult emotions, because you needed to be optimistic and have faith.
Right. And maybe even a sense of trying to not add to her grief or her discomfort, right, by showing her our emotions.
Right.
Maybe a sense of protection of her even from our own pain.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think that's true.
Yeah, so this is tough because on the one hand, I mean, you did such a good job of kind of this double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, our faith and ideas about eternal families are so comforting, right? And they bring so much, I guess, answers when we need them or when we feel hopeless. On the other hand, sometimes the faith and the optimism gets in the way of being able to just feel awful for a while, which is, I think, normal under those mm-hmm. circumstances, and wanting to be able to feel like you have the right to do that without Absolutely. Anybody maybe saying things like, oh, it'll be okay, or you'll see your sister in the afterlife. I mean, I don't know if you got those types of comments after she died.
Yes, no, I did. And it was one of the things, this is, I guess, more uniquely Mormon, but one of the things that really bothered me were there were people that knew our family that maybe were in our ward or friends who said that they had spiritual experiences about my sister. Who said that they, you know, just in varying, you know, all different ways, you know, some it was a dream or they, you know, just an impression, or this one woman in my parents' ward even said that she had seen my sister standing next to her husband at her funeral. And you [S2] Wow. [S1] Know, I believed that these, it's not that I didn't believe these people, that they'd had these spiritual experiences. I did believe them. But it wasn't comforting to me because, you know, I thought, well, why are they having mm-hmm. these experiences? Why are they privy to seeing her and having these experiences and not me, okay?
Is yeah, that's it because, a pretty intimate.
Right. Is it because I'm not righteous enough? I don't have enough faith? They're better than me. For some reason, God wants them to have that experience. I mean, that just was not a comforting thing. But even amongst family members, you know, there were people in my family that were having spiritual experiences and with respect to my sister and her death. And I wasn't having those. And so for me, it became, and this is like I talked about before, this, you know, this distance that I started to feel from, you know, between me and the rest of my family. This kind of helped, it was what her death did not cause me to stop believing in God, but it changed my perception of God. I guess I would say that I kind of became more of a deist, in that I didn't really believe that, I no longer believed that God intervened in the day-to-day life of people, because I couldn't understand how, you know, he couldn't or wouldn't or couldn't heal, you know, my sister who was 27 years old and had a young baby and a young husband and her whole life ahead of her, but he could, you know, give, you know, an answer to prayer for somebody who maybe forgot their notes to their talk and they were inspired to speak to people. You know, you hear these stories and you think, well, it just didn't make sense. And so I had to reshape my perception of God, and I kind of, you know, had this view of a more limited God, maybe someone who, because of course God is good. Of course he would want to heal my sister. There's not, it's not like he's a stingy God who just says, no, sorry, I'm not going to heal you. So it kind of became this, in my mind, God just maybe was bound by rules or laws or something that he couldn't do that. So it was kind of a transition period for me in terms of what I, how I viewed God.
So this type of God that many, you know, many listening will probably be all over the place as far as how they view, you know, their own relationship with God and what God can or cannot do. Oftentimes, however, in Mormonism, you get this sense of, well, that's a trial that, you know, your sister was meant to go through, whereas this other person wasn't. And so for you, that no longer, I guess, passed the test. For you, it was like, no. If we're going to have a compassionate God, and then he would want to heal everyone. He wouldn't be picking certain people to heal, right, or not to heal. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes. And I, you know, and not just heal, but more trivial things, I would say. Like, for instance, you know, people that I know that I, you know, someone that I knew that was very close to me told me a neat experience, you know, the tender mercies of the Lord, where, you know, literally they had forgotten she was supposed to speak at, you know, to a whole group of people, and she had forgotten her notes to her talk, and the Lord, you know, in his tender mercies just inspired her, and she knew exactly what to say, and everything just went perfect, and people were touched and felt the Spirit and all these things. And I just, that just to me was like, well, why would God answer her prayer and not my family's, not my, you know, my family, especially that had so much faith, you know, I mean, they had incredible faith over, I mean, in my, from my view, almost too much faith, you know, too optimistic. Right. So,
and yeah. why would something, when you say trivial, I mean, obviously it was important to her, but something, right, that wasn't life threatening,
wasn't,
right,
life or death,
that she would have survived either, right, whether she had her notes or not. Yeah.
Right. And not only that too, but I mean, you mentioned this idea that, you know, we are sent this belief that God gives us, you know, challenges,
like specific trials.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Specific trials. And I guess at that point, I probably still would have believed that. But when my brother and his sister-in-law were burned, that was something that I could no longer believe in either, because I heard people use that belief or that, you know, that rationale to.
Can you give us a little bit of history of, yeah, what happened? What exactly happened to your brother and sister-in-law?
So they were in a plane crash. They were in a single engine plane. And they were, my brother, they were with, he had just gotten his license, pilot's license. I couldn't believe that God would have any kind of hand in causing something like this to happen. But with that, also, God didn't stop it from happening either. So it's a difficult thing to balance, because on the one hand, you have to come to terms with why this happened. You know, we all want answers, so you want to be able to understand why it happened, and you also want to have this sense of purpose, you know, like it happened for a reason, that it didn't just happen in vain, or that you went through all that suffering for nothing, you know. And I think that can be a good thing for people. It, you know, I think for my brother and his wife, I think their faith has been what's pulled them through. And it's made all the difference in their ability, I think, to move forward and to you know, have the kind of life that they have now. So right. I think it's, it can be, I guess I would say that in my brother and my sister-in-law's case, their faith has been a very positive, you know, I guess coping mechanism, way for them to move forward and be positive and, you know, come to terms with what happened. But I think in my sister's case, that, excuse me, that faith and maybe optimism was not a helpful thing, at least for me, it wasn't, because it didn't allow me to, the pressure to be optimistic took away from my ability to mourn and to process and to be sad and to talk about these kinds of things before my sister died and after she died, right, as well.
I think, didn't the church make a like a video or something about your brother and sister-in-law's story? Wasn't that something that was on the LDS.org or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah, right. Yeah, they did. Well, and I mean, she has, you know, her blog and her, she wrote a book. She's been all over, you know, she's famous.
Right.
She's been on, she's out there. So
sure. Well, that's quite a story.
She's a celebrity.
Sure.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. It really is. It's an amazing story. And it's, you know, my, you know, she, of course, she had lots of priesthood blessings as well. And, you know, from my perspective, I don't necessarily think it was the priesthood that healed her. I think she had excellent medical care, which, you know, I think she would think that too. but you know, it's hard to, it's hard to find, you can't, I guess you can't help but see the good in how someone's faith can pull them through in these difficult, you know, circumstances. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard, you know, Karl Marx say that religion is the opiate of the masses. And, you know, we tend to think of that in a really negative way. But you can kind of twist that a little bit and look at it in more of, I guess, kind of what I was saying earlier, that, you know, an opiate is a painkiller, and life can be painful. It can be hard. We have evil in the world, you know, bad things that happen. And sometimes you need that. You need a painkiller. You need something to help ease that. And I think, you know, faith, belief is something that can help people, you know, helps ease the pain.
Right.
So, well, I hope I didn't offend anybody with the Karl Marx.
No, I think that there's all different kinds of ways of looking at this, and I think it's useful to kind of put that all on the table. I think from, like, a mental health perspective, you know, like, why do I have you on Mormon Mental Health? And kind of tying some of this together, I think it is interesting how many of these things, I think, affect our psychology, right? Our way of thinking, all the, you know, when there's trauma in our life, it obviously affects not only maybe the way we look at our faith, but also how we look at ourselves, how we look at our other relationships in our families. So that's why I think this is a really important topic to bring on. I think just to tangent a little bit and maybe share a little bit of my own experience as you were talking about, you know, who is this God that I believe in and what does he choose or not choose to do, right? Or what, how,
how am I going to frame that? What type of power am I going to give this God that I frame in my mind? For me, that journey started as I really started looking into sexual trauma and working with sexual trauma victims and, you know, experiences in my own life and all that, you know, just not, it not really making sense that this loving Heavenly Father that Mormonism has helped me connect to would, you know, find it useful to say, well, that's something that you should go through too, you know, go through the refiner's fire, you know, those two concepts were opposing for me. And so that's, I think, an interesting concept that I think all of us as members of the church have to grapple with at some level, you know, and some of us may come up with different ways of, how do I want to say, coming up with different conclusions of what that right. all comes to look like. But for me, it was very similar. It was, I could no longer believe in a God that would, you know, heal in certain situations, not heal in certain situations, stop trauma in certain situations, not stop trauma in certain situations. And for me, God became much more of a comforter that when mm-hmm. these things happen and kind of like you mentioned, the laws of physics and, you know, just the laws of the universe, which I think the scriptures speak to, when they occur in our mortal state, that I could see God more as a comforter, regardless of what would or would not happen in my life. Mm-hmm. So, but that, you know, I understand that that goes in contrast with many people who do very much believe in the power of prayer and power of priesthood and healing. And so again, those are just, you know, tough things to try to put all in the same soup bowl, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's hard. So I guess one more question I have about your family, you know, after the death of your sister and, you know, here your father is the patriarch of your whole family system had given this beautiful blessing and, you know, you said commanding her to heal and get well. How have they come to terms with that not coming through the way they had anticipated?
You know, I'm not really sure because it's not something that we really talk about. But I think what might have helped a little bit is that the night that she died, is actually a pretty interesting story of what happened. So I, you know, this was, I heard all this from my dad because I was in the hospital just having given birth that morning to my daughter. And, he said that, you know, she had been getting progressively worse and in more pain over the previous few days. And so they kind of knew that the end was coming. But at the same time, there was this sense that she had, you know, she'd been given this blessing from my dad that she was going to be healed. And my parents were very optimistic up until the very end. And my dad said that right before she died that night, he went in to, you know, say goodnight to her. She was going to bed. And they had a conversation where she asked him about what it was, you know, if he'd ever seen anybody die, or they talked openly about his mother, you know, my grandmother, and when she died, and just about death. And he said that he told her that it was okay for her to pass on, and, you know, I guess kind of in a sense releasing her. Hmm. And literally, I mean, she died just, you know, a few minutes later, I think. And So I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much psychology goes into people being able to hang on to life, or, you know, how much of that is the mind, how much is the body. I don't know, but I think there, up until the end, I think there was this sense of, on my sister's, you know, part, that she had to keep fighting. She couldn't give up, because she'd be letting my parents down if she didn't, if she gave up. Mm-hmm. So I think in a way that she felt the same sense of, I guess, obligation maybe, or duty to be positive, you know,
right? Oh,
just to not stop believing. You have to keep believing, that I felt, you know, and I felt that same pressure to be positive. And it was only when she actually had the permission to kind of, you know, accept what was going to happen to her that she was able to pass on. So, I don't know. I think that maybe, I mean, this is, you know, I don't know, but I think that maybe that was a way of maybe kind of resolving the, what had happened with the priesthood blessing and then her declining health, you know, just having that, having my dad's blessing, I guess.
Sure. Well, and I think of your parents, the last thing I'd want to do or come across as disrespectful to how, you know, their own process and how they dealt with something so traumatic. It just seems like this challenged every single aspect of, you know, you talk about this large Mormon family. I'm sure they're doing all they can just to keep up, right, and keep this structure going. And, you know, I just see this well-oiled mm-hmm. kind of wheels trekking along.
Yeah.
and then, you know, bam, they just get hit with something that is so, I mean, would be difficult for anybody
yes.
in that situation. And then, you know, the way that they coped was to rely, you know, obviously on their faith and everything mm-hmm. that they could. I mean, cancer is such a thing you don't have power over, right? So when you give a blessing mm-hmm. or when you put a name on a temple roll or when you say a prayer, it feels like you can do something, you know, in a situation where you really can do very little.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, not that you can speak for them, but what's your sense of how they have moved on from this or recover? I mean, not that you recover, but how have they, mm-hmm. in a sense, survived this very traumatic experience in their lives?
I think that it has, you know, this is, it's interesting because, again, this goes back to the distance that I felt from my sister's death created. I think that for my parents, it has been, again, this is just from my perspective, but it seems to have been a faith promoting experience for them. I think they, you know, have been able to find comfort in thoughts or impressions or things that people have said, blessings, prayers with respect to my sister. They found comfort in, you know, the plan of salvation and knowing that they're going to see her again. I think overall that it has maybe been something that has strengthened their faith and probably other people in my family as well, which is, you know, interesting to me because for me it was not a faith promoting experience. And I'm not sure what the difference is or why that happened, but I would say that for them, they, you know, they soldier on, you know, they're going to stay strong and endure and keep on, you know, keep on keeping on.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's admirable. It's a good thing. I think that their way of dealing with it for them has been good for them. You know, for me, I don't blame anybody for this. I mean, if anyone's to blame, it's also me because I, you know, well, I should have taken the initiative and talked to my sister about things that, you know, I could have talked to her about. But for me, it just was a different experience, and it's not anybody's fault. It's just, it is what it is. So
where are you at currently? Yeah. I mean, where has all of this led you?
Well, after my, like I said, you know, my view of God kind of changed after my sister died. And then after my brother's accident, I think it just kind of went further along. It became my new concept of God had kind of, you know, cemented more firmly, I guess, after my brother's accident. And then, you know, there's just been a lot of other things that have, you know, contributed to where I'm at now. I would say that I'm a hopeful theist or an agnostic theist. I hope that there is a God. I like the idea of it. I'm not sure that there is one, and I don't necessarily look to God anymore for comfort, although I recognize that and appreciate that for a lot of people that is a source of comfort. He is a source of comfort, or the idea is. And so I have a lot of understanding and respect for people that look to God for comfort. And I think it can be a very healthy, you know, good way for people to cope with tragedy and illness and, you know, evil that in the world. but you know, for me, it wasn't the concept of God was not something that was, you know, a source of comfort for me when I was exposed to difficult things and difficult trials.
Do you feel like that respect has been reciprocated for your journey, that people have respected that things turned out differently for you, that the faith didn't provide the answers or the comfort that seemed to necessitate a relationship with religion?
I don't think that people, I mean, when I say people, I guess do you mean my family or
family or friends
or mm-hmm. I think generally speaking, I think within the Mormon community or even just the larger religious community, I think people have a harder time understanding that. I think it takes a lot of conversations before people can kind of give that same, you know, amount of understanding and respect back. But I do feel it. You know, not to the extent that I would like to feel that, but I do think it's there. And I think over the years, I think it'll, you know, I think there will be more understanding and more acceptance and, yeah.
Right. So what would you say, you know, in doing this podcast, what would be the goals that you would want to put forth? Like what is it that you want people to be able to understand or get, or maybe even reach out to others who've been through something similar?
I would just say that I guess I would encourage people to just talk, communicate about things that are difficult to talk about. And I mean, that sounds so silly and basic, but my experience has been that so much of what we, so many problems and so much heartache and, you know, just all of those things are because we don't communicate honestly with each other. And I guess that is one of my big regrets. And I guess in conjunction with that, that I could have talked or you know, spoken with my family and my sister specifically about my doubts and the way I was feeling about, you know, the pressure that I felt to maybe to have faith or be positive, you know, to not lose faith and to stick with the program. I wish I would have had the, you know, maturity or the courage, or because I'm not exactly sure why I didn't talk about it, but I wish I would have. I wish that I would have had that. And I wish that I could have just spoken honestly with my sister and, you know, asked her, you know, how she felt, like how is she feeling right now about the fact that she might die? What does she want for her child? What does she want for her husband? What is her testimony? What does she think about God? Like, I don't know. Like, did she have doubts right before she died? Was she feeling, was her faith strengthened through all of that? I don't know. And I wish I would have had those conversations with her.
Right. Yeah. So the things that I've heard most from you are have the open communication, not allow our maybe Mormon construct of death and the afterlife, because we have a very specific construct, right? More so, mm-hmm. I think, than even some other religions, where we have a very visualized vision, I guess, of what it's maybe going to look like. And so to not allow that construct to put barriers up from being able to talk about doubts or fears or things that may don't fit into that construct, right? So to be able to tolerate things that might look a little bit different, even though I have this belief or this faith that maybe I'm still scared or maybe I still have doubts, or and to allow for that communication to happen. I think this is probably the main thing I'm gaining from you.
Yeah. And also to realize that not everybody in your, you know, in your faith community, in your family, they might have the same beliefs as you, but they might not derive the same sense of comfort from it that you do. And that's, I think that's where I was at. You know, my beliefs were pretty much in line with everybody in my family, I guess, but I didn't get comforted from it. You know, it didn't bring me comfort.
Right.
And that made me feel isolated and you know, distant from the rest of my family. And I think there's probably a lot of people going through, you know, hard situations that, you know, in just in a ward community that maybe don't find comfort in these, you know, little sayings that we have, you know, going through the refiner's fire, or, you know, we hear these, mm-hmm. these scriptures and these things over and over again at church. And, you know, it might be that those are not comforting to some people.
Sure. Yeah. So not everybody's journey is the same, right? And not to assume. I think that's another big thing I'm hearing, is not just because I have a certain construct of God or of the afterlife or of what those things mean to me, and even though we may share the same religion, that doesn't necessarily mean that's where you're at. And so not to make assumptions and comments that can be really
hurtful. Tread with caution.
Right. Right.
Well, and I think another thing I'm hearing as well is just the importance to respect the possibility for people to take different paths. Like you mentioned, your brother and your sister-in-law, and how, you know, they've remained very faithful to their faith, and they do gain great comfort from that, and it sounds like you have a lot of respect for that. But that wasn't your story, and that wasn't your journey. And to help us understand as a ward family or as a, you know, stake family, that people are going to go different ways when these kinds of tragedies happen, and to still have compassion and empathy. Because I think one thing that I'm concerned about is that people might think less of you, for example, because, you know, you didn't stay strong, or you let this challenge shake your faith, you know, or things like that, that I hear sometimes that are so very dismissive and minimizing of people's experiences. And I don't know if you've ever felt that way, that, that you've been minimized or put into a corner like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's, and whether or not you hear it from other people, there's still that part of, there's that, you know, Mormon part of your brain that tells you that.
That takes you there.
Yeah, that takes you there. So it's there. It's always there.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's what I was getting to before with, you know, self-esteem issues and things, that sometimes these things can really just rock the very core of your identity, right? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess one last thing I'd like to talk about briefly is oftentimes people who go through something like this can be diagnosed with clinical depression or, you know, things along those lines. And that's why I used the word bereavement at the very beginning, because I just want to normalize that it's perfectly healthy to be pretty distraught after a death. And I think you implied that sometimes we don't even allow for that, you know, because, well, we know we're going to be together, so let's just move on, you know, keep your shoulder to the wheel and just right. keep pushing. But that it's actually very normal and healthy to really kind of fall apart and to have, you know, months and years even where you feel like, I'm not really ever going to be the same. Somebody once told me it's kind of like you've hit a new normal. You know, there's you're never really going to go back to an innocent state where this hasn't happened in your life. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you feel are normal, healthy ways to grieve, or accepting grief as part of life?
Yeah, I remember asking my mother-in-law that after my sister died, because her own mother had just passed away the year before. And I remember talking to her about that and asking her, you know, how long does it take, you know, before you feel back to normal? And you know, I remember her telling me for her, it was about a year. And so I had that kind of in my mind that, you know, about a year. And in, you know, historically in Victorian England, they wore their mourning dresses for a year, you know? So I don't know. I just kind of thought, yeah, that sounds about right. Right. And, you know, I had just had my daughter, you know, the same day my sister died, and I was in Arizona with my family. This was right at Christmas time. And, you know, so we had Christmas together, and, you know, I was obviously sad, but it was Christmas and I was with my family. And then, after that, we went back to Maryland, and I was looking back now, I think I definitely had postpartum depression. I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, I just remember going into, you know, my daughter was, this is even when she was, you know, 6, 7 months old, rocking her to sleep at night in her room. And just, I named my daughter after my sister and, just sobbing like almost every night, just, you know, just crying. And then during the day, just feeling like, I was, it was a blur. Like I think back, I try to remember back to the, you know, when my daughter was a few months old, and I just have these, like, it's just kind of blurry. I can't really remember details. Sure. Other than I remember being tired all the time and, you know, taking naps a lot, and, you know, and I didn't know. I'd never been depressed before. I had never had any kind of experience like that. And so, it wasn't, and the funny thing is that my husband was doing his psych rotation at the time.
Oh.
He didn't see it either.
That's funny.
Because, you know, in it just, I don't know, it's just funny that neither of us really saw it. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I was still functioning. I wasn't, you know, horribly, horribly depressed. But I, you know, I had some long, you know, term depression that lasted for about 6 months. And it wasn't until afterwards that I kind of could look back and say, wow, I was depressed. Now, I don't know that I needed to take medication. I don't know. I mean, I came out of it eventually. But I think, yeah, it probably was a normal reaction given the fact that I had just had a baby and my sister had just died. And I think it probably would have really helped if I could have, I feel like I probably wouldn't have had the symptoms or the response that I did if I could have openly mourned, if I could have maybe talked about this and cried openly and shared with other people how I was feeling instead of doing it all alone. You know, I was crying alone in the room with my baby. I didn't cry with my family. I didn't talk on the phone with anybody and cry about my sister. I didn't really even talk about it with my husband, which, you know, we talked about everything, but for some reason we didn't really talk about her. And so I think, yeah, it was something that was not, I don't know. I didn't, and I guess because I didn't feel like it goes back to this sense, this feeling of not having permission to be sad, because I kind of felt like, why, that's wrong for me to just wallow in sadness, because I know I'm going to see her again. I know that it's just going to, you know, it's just a short time, you know, for maybe it's longer for me, but in her mind, it's going to go by fast. We're going to see each other. We're going to live forever together. You know, everything's going to be all right. Why are you sad? So, you know, it just, it was just something that I didn't feel like I was allowed to do.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point too, about talking about the person, right? I've heard many people, who've been through similar tragedies just say, I just had this like desire to talk about the person and nobody really wanted to talk about the person, almost kind of in a sense of that protection again, like, well, we won't talk about it because we don't want her to be sad, right? We don't want to bring it up because we don't want to watch her have to cry again or something. Well, oftentimes that's what people really need, is just to be able to talk about the person and all their memories, and this is what happened, and sometimes you laugh and sometimes you sob, and like, that's all part of it, right?
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because I did feel that when at my sister's funeral, we had the service, you know, at the church, and then that evening my parents had the casket at our house, and they had you know, family and friends and people from the ward stopped by and, you know, paid their respects, I guess. But in the evening, my sister Charity and another one of my sisters had all had our wedding receptions in my parents' house. And then Charity had also had her funeral reception in their house. And we remember thinking that it felt like a wedding reception at times. Not entirely, but at times, because it was such a good experience. You know, people were coming to pay their respects to my sister, and then they stayed and talked, and we talked about her. You know, we sat and talked about funny stories, and I saw, you know, our old friends from college that we knew that we had, you know, hung out with, and we had a good time talking about, you know, our memories of her, of Charity, and funny stories, and, you know, her old seminary teacher came by, and we talked about high school, and, you know, our memories of her in high school, and it was such a warm, good feeling at the time. Like, I just remember that night, and how I remember thinking, this is so weird, because I'm, you know, I'm sad, but I'm also this, but this is so, there's such a good feeling here. And it was so, I don't know, it was great. I liked it, even though it was a solemn occasion. Sure. But there was nothing like that afterwards. It was like that one, that was our time to, you know, mourn, to talk about her, to remember her, you know, in a very formalized, you know, setting, and then you move forward.
Right.
And yeah, it's, I would like to talk about her more to this day, and I don't with my family, at least, you know, I do with my husband and friends and stuff, but just as a group, as a family group, we don't spend a lot of time talking about my sister. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure people do, you know, individually,
right,
with each other maybe or whatever, but, because I think it's hard. And it's hard to, I think people are scared of, you know, saying something wrong or feeling like they're saying something inappropriate or, being misinterpreted. I mean, there's probably a million reasons why people, you know, do or don't talk about things. But I think it's important to remember the person that has passed away and speak often of them.
Yeah, I agree. So one thing also that comes to mind as you talk about kind of the timeline of this happening with, you know, your daughter coming right on the, being born on the day that your sister died. I mean, that's pretty intense, right, as far as mm-hmm. timelines are concerned. And so oftentimes as anniversaries come and go and even seasons come and go, it can be pretty normal to have a different feeling around those times, right, than the rest mm-hmm. of the year. Like you think you're coping pretty well, and then all of a sudden certain emotions get triggered or certain memories, just as you approach anniversaries. Have you noticed that at all, especially when it's tied to your daughter so directly?
And right.
Like you said, you named your daughter after your sister, mm-hmm. and there's all this really beautiful emotional connection.
Yeah, and I think for me personally, it's actually been pretty good, because my family has kind of chosen to remember my sister on her birthday, which is in April. I'm glad, because I don't want my daughter to feel like, you know, we remember her aunt dying on her birthday. There's not that sense at all with my daughter's birthday. But I do think I've noticed that, you know, like my family has the tradition of going, you know, on my sister's birthday, they'll go visit her grave. A couple of times they've had like a memorial, where they had like a slideshow with videos and pictures and stuff. I haven't lived there at the time. I wasn't there at the time, so I haven't been to any of those, but I know that they do that. But for me, it's, you know, I do think about her. I have found that I don't I don't often think about her on the day that she died. I do think about her. I always think about her on her birthday. But I've noticed that things come, I have new feelings and new emotions that come up around it. Just seemingly out of nowhere sometimes, that just have no, I don't even know where it came from. You know, it's been just last year, I think it was, I had this, you know, period of, you know, maybe a couple of weeks where I felt like I had to reprocess everything. I felt like I had to go back and, you know, I talked to my brother-in-law and asked him, like, okay, can we, like, go, like, what happened? And, like, can we reprocess this? And I needed to talk to him about what happened and, like,
this is Charity's husband, you mean?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Yeah, my brother-in-law, yeah. Mm-hmm. And just reprocess it and revisit it and kind of take stock of where I'm at, you know, with what happened to her, with, you know, and combining that with where I'm at now in my life and just reevaluating everything. And I'm sure this won't be the last time that I do that. I'm sure I'll have other moments.
And he was willing to do that with you.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he was. And it was great. And that was a very, very, you know, I did learn something from my past. I made sure that I just was open and said what I needed to say. And it was great. We had a wonderful conversation about it. And, but it seemingly came out of nowhere. I mean, it just, I don't know why. There was nothing really going on in my life that was particularly troublesome, or, you know, nobody was sick. Nobody, you know, I just, right. But then, you know, on the other side of that too, is I think it also affects, sometimes your own grief can affect the way that you, treat other people in similar circumstances. I caught myself doing that with a good friend of mine whose husband is going through chemo and has cancer, and you know, it's pretty iffy whether or not he's going to make it. And but the whole time that he was going through chemo, I didn't realize I was doing this, but I was just distancing myself from her. Not intentionally, but it just, I think because it was so, you know, I still had so many emotions unresolved around my sister's death from cancer that I just kind of had this natural inclination to distance myself from something that was reminiscent of the pain that I had experienced. And, you know, thankfully I kind of caught myself doing that and tried to, you know, reverse that course. But I think that's something else too. I think that's probably, I'm sure I'm not the only one that's done that.
Sure. And so there's a self-awareness process that you're kind of describing as well, of being aware of yourself and your surroundings as you come across new situations.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, just to kind of end this on kind of maybe a standard of care or treatment approach, I mean, I think that what I want people to kind of gain from listening to your experience is that, yeah, there's reactions can be all over the spectrum. And I think whatever it is that you're experiencing, that's okay. You know, it's, people have to experience what they're going to experience, and it's a lifelong process, I think, for many people. Some people carry it very close and kind of present. Some are able to maybe move along quicker, but there's no right or wrong way of grieving. And there's lots of different stages, and we could talk about the stages of grief, but I think a lot of people are familiar with those or could look those up. But there's no linear path through those stages. You know, sometimes you think you're through the anger stage and 10 years later you're back in it, right? And so
right.
I think it's okay to have that and to just kind of understand that it's a process that each one of us go through individually, and there's no right or wrong way to do that. And then, of course, I think talk therapy and in some cases antidepressants and things like that can be helpful for people, even though it may not qualify as clinical depression at first. I think in the diagnostic manual, it actually starts qualifying as clinical depression pretty quickly. It only gives you 2 months, which I'm not really in agreement with. But I think those similar treatments for depression are helpful with cases of bereavement. But I think it's helpful for people to understand that there's a difference, that this is a normal part of life, is to be depressed and struggling after a death of a loved one, and especially when I think it doesn't fall in developmentally correct patterns, right? I mean,
right.
I think most of us expect to lose our parents. Most of us expect to lose our grandparents, and not to minimize the pain and the hurt that comes from those losses as well, but those are more timeline appropriate. Whereas when you lose a child or a sibling or somebody who's kind of in their prime of their youth, it's a very different process, and can be much more challenging or challenging in different ways.
Right. Absolutely.
So is there anything I'm leaving out or anything that you'd like to maybe end with? What are your closing thoughts?
Just thank you for doing this interview. I really appreciate it. I hope that, I'm glad that I could tell my story, and hopefully, maybe others can gain a new perspective, or, not make the same mistakes that I made, learn from my past occurrences, I guess, past choices. But I agree with everything that you said. I think that they're wise words. So thank you. Thank you for saying that. And thank you for conducting this interview.
Well, thanks, Heidi, for being on. And I would encourage you not to be too hard on yourself. Family rules and family systems are hard things to buck, and even hard things to be aware of and in all cases. And we kind of, we work as a system, and it's hard not to fall into those same kind of roles and traditions. So, anyway, I hope you and your family continued healing and hopefully continued progress in your abilities to communicate, especially about Charity. She sounds wonderful, and you've really brought her to life here today. And thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee, Jesus saved.